I'm Zoe Lipman, Director of the Vehicles and Advanced Transportation Program at the Blue-Green Alliance, and I'm very happy to welcome everyone here today for the Build It Here, Manufacturing Electric Vehicles and Advanced Vehicle Technology in America event. We're thrilled to have a great set of speakers lined up today to talk about how the United States and automakers can seize the opportunity to sustain and grow good jobs building the vehicles of the future in America. Unfortunately, recent plant idling proposals like those that GM announced late last year and other disinvestment moves signal that we have urgent work to do to realize the potential for the industry, manufacturing, and jobs in America. Before I introduce our opening speakers, I have to do a quick bit of housekeeping. For reporters on the phone, you can email any questions to our panel, which will follow the congresspeople, to aharvey@bluegreenalliance.org. So we're very happy to be joined today by two members of Congress. Both of our first two speakers are deeply familiar with the impact of automotive investment decisions on working people in their districts. Kicking off our event, I'm honored to introduce Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who represents Michigan's 12th District. Throughout her time in office, she has been a leader on efforts to grow manufacturing and a voice for working families. Congresswoman Dingell is no stranger to today's topic, having worked in the auto industry and been deeply engaged on the Midwest's automotive and manufacturing future for decades. So without further ado, Congressman Debbie Dingell.
Good afternoon, and it's great to be here with the Blue-Green Alliance, but more as important to be here with my colleague from Maryland, who I said should go in front of me, Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger, who's been a mentor to me, who I've learned much. And it's nice to have people outside of Michigan at times care about the auto industry, and that didn't come out quite right, but sometimes we're all... And also to be here with Josh Nasser from the UAW, who's a great friend, and the UAW is my partner in everything I do. But this is actually the second time in 24 hours I've been at the National Press Club talking about electric vehicles. Yesterday, I was with the coalition of the auto OEMs and suppliers and the utility industry. So today, I'm here with the environmentalist community and the media community. And yesterday I had some pretty strong messages to say to them, and I guess the only thing that's changed is since I talked to everybody yesterday, we did have a nice announcement from Fiat Chrysler that they plan to invest $4.5 billion to build a new assembly plant in Detroit and add production to five Michigan plants. So it shows you that you can build in America. We have men, working men and women who can do those jobs here in this country. And I can't start this conversation without making my point that General Motors doesn't have to go to Mexico and pay only $1.50 to $3.50 an hour and then bring those vehicles back into the United States of America. We need trade power. I was just saying to Josh, I've told Lighthizer this multiple times, I will not call NAFTA 2.0 anything but NAFTA 2.0 because NAFTA 1.0 is what closed and shuttered our plants in Mexico. And as we talk about production, we make the best vehicles in the world. We have great men and women who make those vehicles, and we need to talk about policies that are going to keep that here. So we are building electric vehicles here, and I want to see the future of electric vehicles stay in the United States of America. And anyone who says that that's not what's happening is dead wrong, and we've got the numbers to prove it. At this moment, the U.S. and global market for electric vehicles is expanding rapidly. In 2018, more than 2 million plug-in and battery electric vehicles were sold worldwide, a nearly 40% increase over 2017. And those strong global sales projections will likely continue into 2019. As recently as 2012, there were only five electric vehicle models available for sale to the public. Just 6 years later, there are now 48 models being offered by a wide array of companies, including 16 battery electric models, 29 plug-in hybrids, and 3 fuel cell electric models, with more on the way. Tomorrow's here. The future's arrived. And electric vehicles are changing the way of life as we speak. But as we say that, there's some real issues that we also have. You know, I have a lot of I get tired, and I had many of these conversations with Governor Brown, which Josh and Brad knew that I had, when he would talk about we need to build electric vehicles and the Chinese are doing it. Well, we've got a problem. China's got a government that tells people you're going to drive electric vehicles, and they kind of mandate it. We don't have a government that can just mandate to consumers this is what you're going to buy. We have to sell vehicles that consumers are going to buy. And we do. All of us share the goal. Global climate is real. And we do want to go to a carbonless society, which means we need more electric vehicles. And all of the, you will see the OEMs are building those now in this country, but people aren't buying them. And why are people not buying them the way we want them to buy? Because we don't have the infrastructure to support it. We don't have the charging stations. And so what we need to be doing now is to working together as we build out the infrastructure and repair the infrastructure in this country is to build the infrastructure to support electric vehicles. I would AOC has become a good friend of mine, and we talk about a lot of things. And she talks about the green project. And I went to her, right? This was now... Well, like probably swearing in day, and I've had multiple conversations with her since then. And I said, I want to work with you. If we're going to go to the carbonless vision that you have, we got to sell electric vehicles, but nobody's buying them because we don't have the grid. So will you work with me to help build that grid? She said, absolutely. And I've invited her to cut Josh. I think I told you this, but my life's been a little in the last few weeks. That she has said that she's going to come. And I want her to spend time in Detroit with the OEMs. But we also, as we're talking about where electric vehicles are going, we've also got to, right now people go into a gas station and they're used to filling their car in 5 minutes. When we build the grid, it's still going to take 30 minutes to charge. People need to build the confidence in the range, and they've got to have that. So there's going to have to be a consumer change. Hopefully, we're going to develop the technology at some point that's going to speed up that recharging and let it happen more quickly as well. And this is one of the things I really worry about, is that as we're building new homes, building the infrastructure inside people's garages, having the right outlet to charge a vehicle. It's going to take one fire. I say to Uber, and Greg always tries me not to say this, but I do anyway. Greg, by the way, such as my chief of staff right here. Uber did more to hurt autonomous vehicles with that one accident than anybody else did in this country. Consumer confidence is not totally on autonomous vehicles because people are worried about the technology, the innovation. It's going to take one fire because someone didn't have the right charge there. It's going to further worry everybody about electric vehicles. And that's what I'm very focused on, is to building that infrastructure so that consumers will have the confidence in the electric vehicles. So, you know, as it comes to the work ahead in the 116th Congress, the Energy and Commerce Committee has major plans to address and help highlight the importance of electric vehicles for our future economy. We've had our first hearings on climate change. We need to make these significant investments that I've talked about in electric vehicle charging infrastructure for all communities, to increase the deployment and adoption of electric vehicles, which will simultaneously create a pathway to clean energy future. Now, the other issue that, and this is sort of what I hammered home yesterday, we're at a critical point for the future of the EV tax credit. The tax credit has proven to be one of the factors that can help incentivize. EVs are more expensive, and that tax credit helps incentivize a consumer for both manufacturing and public adoption. Giving up on that now is a mistake. But we're not going to get that if we don't get everybody together on one page. And this, I don't even know the word to use. I'll let Josh put a word to it. But the industry, and what I think we need on EVs is to incentivize, not subsidize. That is the key as we figure out what this policy, public policy is. So we got to work together to develop that consensus on the tax credit. You know, and I'm going to say to you that there even, you know, we've got other issues going on right now when you talk about the mid-cycle review. And that standard was set with an assumption that there'd be far more purchases of electric vehicles than happened in this country. And, oh, by the way, those states that were pushing it were all going to go buy fleets of those electric vehicles, and they haven't done it. So why haven't they done it? Because of the issues we were just talking about, range, infrastructure, et cetera. So we've got to, I'm committed to making sure the federal government's going to do all that it can to make electric vehicles a success. And that is where one of the future lies. And I get very, when people say China's so far ahead of us, China's ahead of us because they dictate. We have to create the demand, and we have to help create that demand. We have to protect jobs. We have to create that demand by building the infrastructure that's going to support it. So I think I'll stop there and let my colleague from Maryland take over.
Thanks very much, Congresswoman. It's now my pleasure to introduce Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger. Congressman Ruppersberger is serving his ninth term in the United States House of Representatives, representing the citizens of Maryland's 2nd District, which includes portions of Baltimore and the surrounding counties. He's known as a common-sense consensus builder who works with members from both sides of the aisle with job creation and improving Maryland's economy as key priorities. I'm very happy to welcome you.
Well, I'm glad we can be here to talk about an issue that's important to our constituents, important to our country. And first thing, Debbie, you know, I really got to know your husband when I was a freshman, and because of the fact that I represent Allison Transmission. And he was the man who dealt with the automobile industry and manufacturing. And as a result of that, we had a great relationship. He sat at a certain place on the floor, second row, and we would always come up, and he would hold court sometimes. I also remember, you know, I have two new knees, and he had problems with his knees. And I said, well, why don't you try a knee replacement? I think it works. He said, I'd love to, but my wife won't let me. So, whatever. Okay, well, first, I'm going to talk really about the Allison Transmission and a little bit about the history and about really where we are now and where we need to go. You know, I remember the day, it was October 29th, 2007, when the very first hybrid transmission for light-duty truck was hoisted off the assembly line at the General Motors plant in White Marsh in the 2nd Congressional District, which is mine. It was a two-mode transportation that uses gasoline and battery power. They debuted in the 2009 Chevy Tahoe GMC Yukon Hybrid, and the latter of which quickly I purchased and loved. Then they stopped making it, by the way, but that was later because they felt it wasn't efficient, but whatever. Now, I do want to say, and before that, I was a Baltimore County executive for Baltimore County, about 800,000 people, and we were competing to have Allison Transmission come to our jurisdiction. We had a plant in Baltimore, which was not a modern plant, in Baltimore City. And Barbara Mikulski and I went to General Motors to Detroit. We tried to say we need this plant, we have jobs at stake, and we kind of knew when it was over that we couldn't save it. But then we had this new opportunity with Allison Transmission. And I think the reason that we got Allison Transmission is because not only we were geographically in a good location near 95, but we provided job training through our community colleges for all of the people that worked at the plant in Baltimore City to work in a modern robotic plant. And I was always loved to give, when I gave speeches, to talk about Allison, probably one of the most modern plants in the world. And it allowed us to compete internationally. And we had a great plant. It was unique. We had a great workforce, well-trained workforce. And we thought, really, we'd have Allison there forever, but things did change. Now, I talked then in May of 2011. I attended the groundbreaking of this new facility. This one that would be the first electronic motor manufacturing facility in the U.S. operated by a major automaker, General Motors. We were so excited, so proud, and as I'm in Congress now, that our workforce was putting the metal to the pedal and creating competitive and environmentally friendly vehicles that people wanted to drive. And as I said, including me, to this day I still have a GMC. So it was with utter shock that we learned last year that General Motors was going to end production at this particular facility in White Marsh. This is a plant that's large and modern with a highly skilled workforce. One of GM's best based on the company's own corporate metrics. And even more confusing to us was the company's explanation that it wants to focus on light-duty trucks, SUVs, self-driving, and electric vehicles. Well, the White Marsh plant, that they make hybrid transmission for light-duty trucks and electric motors. So it's perfect. Why are you closing this plant, the modern plant? Well, we met our delegation, some of us in the Maryland delegation, and we met with Mary Barra, who's the CEO and the new, I guess she's CEO and president of General Motors now. And she gave her statement, and we gave our statement, and we showed how great Allison was, the workforce, how modern it was. And, you know, in the end, I think if you've been in this business for a while, you know when something's going to happen. I mean, they can come and meet with us and show us respect, but not what we wanted to hear. And we were saying, too, that this realignment is something that all American automakers pursue. We have to increase the production of these advanced technologies in the United States, which we did, instead of taking them offshore to other countries. Now, it's my understanding that the closure in my district, but other places like Detroit, is part of a larger restructuring plan that will eliminate approximately 15% of the company's North American workforce and shift much of its production to China and Mexico. And to me, that makes no sense when we've got the workforce and the facilities here. Now, today, I stand with the Blue-Green Alliance and the UAW in urging U.S. automakers to repurpose our workers, facilities, and production lines to advance electric cars here in America. By investing in clean energy manufacturing projects, we're not only creating good jobs now, but taking steps to mitigate the consequences of climate change and fueling our energy independence. I'm deeply concerned that the money our country pays to sustain foreign nations for oil often winds up in the pockets of extremists. So, by the way, there is a national security aspect to this. I do specialize in national security. I was in the leadership and intelligence. I'm on the defense appropriations, so I deal with a lot of that. And we have a lot of issues on where we spent money for foreign countries, and that money goes right into, not to the people, but into the hands of the extremists and their leadership. Now, we're also asking our automakers not to abandon the workers and communities that have supported them in harder times. And this is what really bugs me, big time. Let's not forget that the American people came to GM's aid in a time of crisis. In addition, we gave them to keep General Motors alive in our car industry in the United States, $50 billion, not million, but billion taxpayer bailout dollars, and a tax cut from the Republican law just passed, which they have received also $115 million in federal, state, and local grants, and yet they're closing our plants. It makes no sense. Now, we're saying you have a responsibility not just to shareholders, but to the workforce and the taxpayers who provided you with so much financial support when you were down and you needed us. Now, Congress also has a responsibility to our constituents to support this effort. For example, I plan to reintroduce my electric and alternative vehicle tax credit bill to give Americans more financial incentives to invest in clean transportation and alternatives for themselves. And I'll continue to support legislation that advances fair trade and a clean infrastructure package and workers' rights. Now, when we can grow good jobs reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and take steps to address climate change, it's a no-brainer. And I want to thank our friends from the Blue-Green Alliance, the UAW, for their leadership on this effort. Special shout-out to my local guy, Guy White, who's here representing Local 238 out of the White Marsh plant. And, Debbie, I'm so happy we have you here because you know your business. You know this subject matter probably as well as any member of Congress. So, you know, we're gonna need your help and your advice and your ability to argue strongly and fight for what you believe in. So we're here to acknowledge where we are, where we need to go, and what we need to do for our workers, not only for our workers, but also for America. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Congressman. I think we'll let our congresspeople go unless they want to stay. I know folks have to get to votes. I suppose if there's any quick...
Chair Coolidge, I'm Eric Coolish, Automotive News. Thank you for that discussion. I didn't hear any specific policy ideas. Automotive News. You know, like for the charging infrastructure, you know, we're having difficulty getting regular infrastructure funded. So what's the idea behind how we pay for that? Or is that a private, public, private sector type of initiative? And then can you give us a little more update on the EV tax credit status and how you guys plan to get that renewed. I know you had said in December that maybe GM shouldn't get the tax credit because you were mad about.
I'm still annoyed.
We're approaching this both from a federal perspective and then there are public-private partnerships. The utility industry is certainly a significant part of that discussion. I'm one of the optimists. I don't know where you are, that we actually can get an infrastructure bill. And any infrastructure bill we do has to include updating of the electrical grid in those charging stations. But the utility industry itself recognizes that this is a priority. So Patty Poppy from Consumers Power in Michigan and there had been one CEO, but the company went bankrupt. So the new CEO that's co-chairing is the lower part of California. I'm having a brain, whatever, but they're co-chairing it for the industry, which I think is important to have California and Michigan. And they're talking about what the utilities themselves need. In Michigan, we've got a whole coalition that of people that are working with our state legislature. So like many of the things that have happened in the auto industry, where there are things that happen at the state level and there are things that happen at the federal level. And my message yesterday to the OEMs is get on the same page, because we're not going to reward one company who's been closing plants and putting – sorry, I know Dave's over there writing already. Debbie's still bashing General Motors. But but you agree with me. Companies who want to get incentives from us need to be putting their jobs in this country. The news yesterday from SEA was very – very positive.
I agree with what Debbie said. I think if any entity that you have, and we're talking about General Motors, electric cars, and that type of thing, you have to have an infrastructure. And I believe if you want to be successful, end game, and that's what our goal is, end game, to have electric cars and to be able to move into that realm, you need to have the business community, the government, coming together to develop this. So the government can't pay for it all. And so there's a lot of money out there in what's going to happen if we do this right. So it's got to be a partnership all the way through. And then after we get what we need, our great workforce will come in and do what they need to do, as they always have.
Last question. I know folks
have to. Ladies, go first.
In terms of the way forward on the tax credit, GM's tax credit is already in the process of scaling down zero on the 6 months.
I mean, it's up against the cap.
Right, exactly. Okay. So they already hit the 200,000 cap, and the
eventually goes to zero. What's the way forward? Do you think Congress will extend the cap temporarily? Will it give auto companies some additional room? I mean, what are the prospects for any action on that?
I think everybody's talking, and we're hoping that they'll come to an agreement among people. So I don't – everybody's got to get on the same page. Maybe Josh can address that later.
Well, I think with that, maybe
it is important. No, it is an issue, and the companies all have to get on the same page. That's part of the problem right now. And until they're all on the same page, you're not going to reward a company that's moving jobs to Mexico and closing plants shouldn't be a company that's getting a benefit. I guess I will be that point blank, and something tells me Jim's going to be after me again tomorrow.
Well, with that,
I'm just saying, it's not be after you. You're doing the right thing. And, you know, we're trying to work with them to get what we need. Don't shut modern plants. Don't put our people out of work and take them offshore. That's the way it used to be. And so I think we've shown that we can compete internationally if you have a modern plant and you have workers that are well-trained. So, you know, that'll be an issue. The good news for Debbie and I, we're in the majority on the House side. So I think a lot of these agendas that we care about, we should have some leverage now to make things happen.
Well, you know, I'm going to say one more thing, that I do want to give credit to General Motors for the number of models that they have. You know, we've gone from 5 to 29 models of electric vehicles, and they are building them. And electric vehicles are part of the future because of global climate changes. We do want to go to a carbonless, but we need the companies to all be in the same page. We want those vehicles. We want this country to stay at the forefront of innovation and technology. We want to create it here, but we want those jobs here. And if we're going to help somebody, it's for jobs here in America, not to go ship them to Mexico.
When you're talking about infrastructure and electric cars, we've got still a long way to go. You have to have the infrastructure there. It's the same thing, Medicare for all. You know, that's a great concept, but how do you pay for it? And let's take care of what we have right now. We almost lost Obamacare. So, you know, if we can develop a concept that works, it's end game. And that's the issue with electric cars. You know, how long do they last? Are you going to have a station in every McDonald's or Burger King or that type of thing? So there's a lot more to go forward with, and we have a lot of research to do. But we just don't need our companies sending jobs overseas when we subsidize those companies in the past. I think we got like one more question because we've got votes in 15 minutes.
Well, it's not only can fit into, they do. They are the carbonless society. That's how you get there. She was more than, she understood it. I said, people aren't buying them, and they're not buying them because they don't have confidence in them. They can't, well, one, we do need to be able to afford them, but people aren't buying them because they don't have confidence in the range. You know, we have some fuel cell electric vehicles too, but until we put the range in and we've got charging stations, people aren't going to buy them. So we got to work together to get to incentivize people moving to that kind of to that product. You know, I used to have great conversations with Governor Brown, who always made, well, China's building them. Well, China's building them because they're mandating. They're telling consumers they have to buy it. Try telling somebody in this country they have to buy an electric vehicle. And, oh, by the way, you may not be, you know, run out on the way to work, your car. It's, you know, we need to help build the infrastructure that will support that consumer demand.
Wonderful. With that, thanks very much. Both the congresspeople. And we have a panel coming up now, and there'll be opportunity for much more discussion and questions as well.
Well, we'll be there.
I can do it. End up there. Wonderful. Thanks, folks. I'm very happy to now introduce the rest of our panel. Our I'm joined here today by Josh Nasser, the Legislative Director of the United Auto Workers, Guy White, Chairman of UAW Local 239, that's General Motors Global Propulsion Systems and Allison Transmission in the Baltimore plant, and Luke Tonichel, Director of the Clean Fuels and Vehicles Group at National Resources Defense Council. We're very happy to have the whole panel here today. I'm going to do a brief introduction myself and turn over to the rest of our panel, and then we'll have an opportunity for additional questions, including from the phone. Over the past decade, U.S. workers and manufacturers have proven, as we heard already today eloquently, that America can lead in clean vehicle technology and rebuild jobs. With a combination of strong policy and manufacturing investment, the industry has brought back hundreds of thousands of jobs while at the same time achieving record sales and transforming its innovation and global competitiveness. And this is all while implementing world-leading fuel economy and greenhouse gas standards. In 2017, Blue Green Alliance and NRDC Research found nearly 300,000 manufacturing workers across the nation making the specific components and materials that go into improving fuel economy and cutting emissions in today's innovative vehicles. Now, just as the industry is being transformed technologically worldwide, we're seeing moves that could put these economic and jobs gains at risk. The GM announcement is just one example of a disturbing trend of disinvestment, outsourcing, and offshoring. These decisions not only have negative implications for jobs in assembly plants, but have a ripple effect throughout the supply chain, threatening innovation and job creation and negatively impacting the national economy and the environment. At the same time, actions by the administration, like their proposal to roll back highly successful clean car standards, are also having direct negative impacts on the economy. The administration's own data shows that a rollback would cut investment in advanced vehicle components and technology by about $30 billion a year and result in 60,000 fewer jobs across the automotive industry. This is no time to go backwards. We need to reverse this disinvestment trend, do more to secure and improve today's jobs while doing everything in our power to bring manufacturing and the next generation of electric and other advanced vehicle technologies to the U.S. If we do this right, we can rebuild American jobs, manufacturing, and communities. But if we don't lead, we risk ceding jobs to other countries and losing our competitive edge. This is no time to leave working people in America behind. Workers at cutting-edge GM plants that we are talking about today and many others prove that we can build the tech of the future here. We should have workers' backs. If we want to ensure America competes in the race to develop and build fuel-efficient electric vehicles and the jobs and economic gains that go with them, companies and policymakers need to make better decisions. We need a national agenda to lead on clean vehicle standards and promote EV and advanced vehicle tech production here in the U.S. And with that, I will turn over to Josh.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to keep my remarks very short because I think it's really important to hear from the other speakers and what's going on the ground. But I do want to say a couple things. First of all, I wanted to thank BGA and the representatives who had to go for votes for organizing and for being here today. It's really an honor for UAW to join, and also on behalf of our 1 million members, retirees, and President Jones and our entire executive board. UAW members and retirees heavily rely on the health of the U.S. auto industry. And one thing that we have seen, unfortunately, is we have seen a real policy failure where we have expected, basically, if you create tax credits or et cetera for companies, then they'll just do the right thing and they'll invest in the United States. And we're seeing that not happen. And we are worried that the vehicles of the future will not be built in the United States over time. There's no question that where our members of UAW, we're used to innovation. We welcome innovation. We have no problem with that. But we need to make sure that investments are made in the United States if we're going to keep that edge. And unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence that we're losing it. We really need a few things. One is that we need trade policies that really put workers first and make it harder to offshore. We need to really invest in infrastructure, as the Congress members talked about. And we also need fuel economy standards that are sensible and achievable and also predictable. And what's going on now really is creating some real problems for the U.S. auto industry and for our membership. So in short, we're at a crossroads, and we need to, as a country, need to make a very deliberate choice to invest in the vehicles of the future, or we are going to fall behind so far that the U.S. auto industry will not look anything like it looks like today in a few decades. So we're worried about what's going on today and the long-term implications. So I think this discussion is very important, and we look forward to working with all parties to advance an agenda that's good for our economy and for working people here. So with that, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name's Guy White, and I'm the shop chairman of Local 239 at the Allison Transmission Facility. A little bit about myself. I started out at the Burning Highway Assembly Plant. We made M-vans. I don't know if you remember the Astro and Safari van, but that's what we made at Burning Highway. 2000, I transferred to White Marsh. At White Marsh, I got retrained. I was a pipe fitter at Burning Highway. And at White Marsh, I got retrained to be a machine repairman. 10 years ago, by chance, I got involved in the UAW. I was a committee person, and now I'm the shop chairman. And I could talk all day about the facility because I love that facility. And I care deeply about my membership and the impact that's going to be bestowed upon them when the closing happens in May. But a little bit about the facility. We the bread and butter of our facility is the A1000 Allison transmission, and it's a highly regarded heavy duty pickup truck transmission. If you buy a heavy duty GMC or Chevrolet pickup truck with a Duramax diesel and an automatic transmission, it's going to be our Allison transmission. It's the benchmark of the industry as far as transmissions go. And that's what pays the bills, our A1000. But in 2007, we started dabbling into electrification, and we started with the transmission that the congressman had, the X20R, which was an automatic transmission that had an electric motor inside of it and a regenerative capacity within the vehicle that would charge the battery, and it would run off the electric motor, then the gasoline engine would kick in. And we did this over 10 years ago. We built that transmission for 5 years, sold about 40,000 of them. Kind of petered out. We got the motor from Delco Rainey in Mexico. And right around when that was ending, we got an investment from the federal government in the state of Maryland and Baltimore County to put an addition onto our plant to build electric motors. So in 2013, we started, although we're still building the A1000, we're still building that today, but in 2013, we started building the GXE drive unit, which was really a gearbox with an electric motor, and it was used in the all-electric Spark, which was manufactured in Korea. So we're exporting these drive units to Korea. The motor for the drive unit was manufactured right next door. We assembled the unit in our side of the plant, gets shipped to Korea. We made 10,000 units, and I know that we had one questionable warranty claim in those 10,000 units. And you could look at the bottom of this drive unit. It was all scraped up. Customer didn't know anything about it, but, you know, you could see that they hit something, right? And that was the only warranty claim that we had in 10,000 units. made that for a couple of years, and then the second generation's coming along. GM decided to outsource that work to LG in Korea, so we lost that product. 2016, we started. I'm sorry, in 2014, we started with the GRE transmission, and that was a transmission that had two electric motors. Once again, made next door. That went into an automatic transmission, sort of like our X20R that I described earlier, and that goes into a CT6 Cadillac that's manufactured in China. So we're exporting these transmissions to China. If you want one of these CT6 Cadillacs, you got to order it from China because we don't make them in the U.S. Don't ask me why. But so we made 2,000 of those, and the plug got pulled on those because we're just not selling a lot of them. So now it brings us up to date where we have an electric motor building that's sitting idle, no activity whatsoever. Our A1000 is due to run out next month, so we won't be manufacturing that either. We won't be manufacturing anything. And it's hard to stomach given, I got a laundry list of awards that we've won here. These are green awards, by the way. The latest award we got was 2018 EPA Energy Star Challenge for Industry. We were handed that award. And going back to 2009, every year we win some sort of green award for our facility. Our facility's a wildlife habitat. It's been certified by the Wildlife Habitat Council. Our facility has a rooftop solar installation that's the second largest in Maryland. It's debatable if we're the largest in GM. It's kind of a who's bigger kind of thing, but I know if we're not number one, we're number two. 10% of our electricity comes from our solar panels. We produce 1.6 megawatts of electricity from our solar installation. Our plant's 20 years old. The e-motor building is 7 years old. 570,000 square feet of manufacturing space. We're a landfill-free site. We were the first landfill-free site in all of General Motors, and we've been a landfill-free site since 2000. People side of the business, we've won. 2017 is the last data that I have because they didn't give us the 2018 data. 2017 data, we were the top performing powertrain plant in all of GM. We had the best attendance of any plant in North America, bar none. That's Canada, Mexico, all of North America. So I have a hard time understanding why our facility is not being utilized. And there's also the human effect on this, that we have membership that it's going to be, I don't want to say traumatic, but I mean, a lot of these people, it's actually getting old hat to some of them because some of them moved 4 and 5 times. So they're going to have to move again. And I could tell you horror stories associated with moving, but it seems to me that we've made electric motors. We've been involved with the electrification of the auto industry, and yet we're not a player in this. And I think we could be a significant player if they would only give us a chance. So, with that.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, both Guy and Josh. And Luke?
Good afternoon. My name is Luke Tonneschell. I direct our Clean Vehicles and Fuels group at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And it's a real pleasure and a privilege to be here. And thank you all for your attention. You know, NRDC believes that a healthy environment and a strong economy go hand in hand. We can have a climate-safe world, and we can protect everyone's right to clean air and to clean water while we are providing good jobs. Now, to avoid dangerous climate change, we must act quickly and boldly, including in the transportation sector, which is the number one emitter of climate-altering pollution. To cut transportation pollution We must accelerate the adoption of clean technologies for advanced gasoline and electric vehicles. And that's not just cars. It's cars, it's trucks, it's heavy-duty equipment, it's freight vehicles. We can make all of them go farther on a gallon of gas and electrify them. And when we look at the fact that the scientists tell us that now is the time for really crucial big actions, we take that to realize that we have to get all the benefits we can from the vehicles that make up the most of the marketplace, which is now gasoline and diesel vehicles, as well as transitioning as fast as we can to electric technologies. We absolutely believe that and share UAW's belief that in accelerating this transition, we need to do it in a way that brings more good jobs in America. And we absolutely can do that. We can be putting more technology into gasoline vehicles while we are building out the manufacturing of new electric technologies in much greater numbers. In fact, the U.S. really should be a global leader in manufacturing clean advanced vehicles. Unfortunately, with this federal administration, we're on the wrong track. The unjustified and illegal plan to roll back the federal standards is a big step in the wrong direction. We know that it'll be a major disruptor of U.S. innovation and therefore jobs. And as Zoe pointed out earlier, we know that at least 60,000 jobs are at risk with the freeze that's been proposed. So we really need to take a different tact. The federal government needs to refocus on the opportunity in front of us to grow jobs in a clean energy and clean transportation economy. That's where the rest of the world wants to go, and American workers should lead the way by building innovative products for the U.S. and for global markets. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, folks. And I think we'll open up for questions. At this point, I would also remind anyone who's on the phone who wants to ask a question that they should email it to aharvey@bluegreenalliance.org. And with that, I guess I'd open up for questions.
What do you think the prospects are, so Dave Shepard, so from Reuters, what do you think the prospects are for some kind of settlement agreement between California and the administration regarding the CAFE rules through 2025? Is it now inevitable that there's going to be a protracted legal battle over those standards? And maybe you could discuss how secure ground you think the administration is on moving to dramatically scale back the Obama-era rules.
Well, I mentioned in my comments that I think that the rollback that's been proposed is both unjustified and illegal. That doesn't foreclose chances for coming to an agreement. Unfortunately, we've been hearing signals that those discussions aren't happening. And it's still not too late. We haven't seen a final rule, and once a final rule comes out, I think if it's still, you know, obviously if it's still put forth in the way that it was proposed, then there's you know, there's likely to be a legal battle that comes from that.
I don't want to make a prediction on the outcome, but I would just underscore how critical it is that we don't see a rollback and we come to some sort of other outcome. Because, as we both mentioned in our comments, if we were to see a rollback of the sort that's being proposed, not only do we see this short-term dramatic cut in annual investment in automotive technology, which affects manufacturers throughout the supply chain in the short term, but we also see medium and long-term effects. We're already hearing what we would be sending is a signal that the U.S. is not a player, and as Europe and Asia move ahead with standards that signal that they are serious about advanced technologies of all kinds, not just electric, but advanced conventional as well, we're seeing the next generation of investments in things like 48-volt systems and others already being made outside of the U.S. by multinational companies. And then there's the medium-term situation that if we don't move fast across the supply chain to innovate into the electric sector, we could be in a very severe situation as the global industry changes and we have lost our competitiveness across the supply chain. And so for all those reasons, having maintaining strong standards and a strong trajectory out ideally through 2030, in fact, would be optimal to strengthen jobs and build manufacturing in the U.S.
I just want to add one thing. First of all, you know, we reject, of course, the false choice between it's got to be good for the environment and good for workers. We've seen that we could do both. I think one thing that I want to add is that we very much believe that climate change needs to be addressed and it's a very serious problem. But our support for strong standards has to do with the economics very much as well. Because as Zoe was saying, the reality is that it's a global marketplace. And if you don't have the incentives for companies to innovate in the export market, it's going to happen elsewhere. So it's really from an economic standpoint that we really hope that all the parties will get together and have a reasonable standard that's predictable.
The Allison transmissions are going to move to?
The Allison branded transmission is moving to Toledo, Ohio. That they decided 6 speeds aren't enough, and they're going to a 10-speed transmission. So it's not. It's a transmission that's been blessed by Allison. It's not really. Can't really say it's Allison, but it's been endorsed by Allison.
So this one's out of production. There's a 10-speed coming?
Correct.
Do we have any questions from the phone?
No.
Other questions? Well, with that, thank you very much to everyone who participated in the panel and certainly our congresspeople, and thanks very much for everyone who's joined us here today and on the phone. Appreciate it, and I'm sure I point folks to the materials also from all of the different panelists and organizations that are out on the way out for those who may be interested in more information. Thanks again.